This podcast is, of course, made possible through the support of our members and from Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community with convenient locations throughout northern New England. World-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more. Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Support for The Exchange weekly New Hampshire News Roundup is made possible by Eastern Bank. We're here, you're first.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Brady Carlson. This is The Exchange. It's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. The 2016 campaign has been raucous, to say the least, and this week New Hampshire found itself in the middle of the fray. Republican U.S. Senator Kelly Ayotte sharply criticized her party's presidential nominee, Donald Trump, over his comments about a Muslim American Gold Star family. Trump responded with sharp words of his own about Ayotte, claiming she'd given his campaign no support and that he was out-polling her in her home state. A new poll from WBUR says maybe not. Steve Cazella of the Mass Inc. polling group says the last few weeks have taken their toll on Trump's reputation with New Hampshire voters.
We found overall 31% of New Hampshire voters see Donald Trump fit to be president. The interesting number to me, though, is even among registered Republicans, only 57% of them think that Donald Trump is fit to be president. So even the people that should like him the best still have questions about his fitness.
The Environmental Protection Agency accuses one of the state's biggest real estate developers of violating lead paint laws in an apartment complex in Manchester. Former tenant Kurt Milligan says he wishes the EPA had done more.
I'm really disappointed that they're able to continue to have people in that building when there is still clear and present danger for folks living there.
While homelessness remains a serious problem, we did see a bright spot in new data about the issue this week. New Hampshire's population of homeless veterans is smaller, and the vast majority of them are in shelters. Maureen Ryan, the director of the state's Office of Human Services, says the state has improved its process for helping homeless vets.
For those that are willing to work with the VA, we're able to get them connected very quickly. But for those who aren't willing to work from the VA, we have outreach workers and shelter staff that have learned more about how to help these folks get connected to services and benefits as well.
Today on The Exchange, it's our weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. Let's hear from you. What questions do you have about this week's news in New Hampshire? The Exchange number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-6477. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. Our guests for the hour are Casey McDermott, NHPR's digital reporter. Casey, great to have you.
Good morning.
Trent Spinner, executive editor of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News. Great to have you, Trent.
Hi, Brady.
And Dean Spiliotis, civic scholar in the School of Arts and Sciences at Southern New Hampshire University and author of the website NH Political Capital. Good morning, Dean.
Good morning, Brady.
Let's start with a look at how New Hampshire ended up in the middle of the political news of the week. Here's what Donald Trump said this week, Dean, to the Washington Post. Quote, "You have Kelly Ayotte, who doesn't want to talk about Trump, but I'm beating her in the polls by a lot." He also goes on to say, "I don't know Kelly Ayotte. I know she's given me no support, zero support. We need loyal people in this country." How did we get to Kelly Ayotte when this appeared, at least for a while, to be more about Donald Trump's relationship with House Speaker Paul Ryan?
Right. Well, Kelly Ayotte stepped in to criticize Donald Trump for his treatment of the Khan family. This is the captain who was killed, I think, in 2004. We saw his parents, his father in particular, give a very moving speech at the Democratic National Committee, and Donald Trump has been sparring on this issue for some time now. Kelly Ayotte came out and said she was appalled by it, that he had a tremendous amount of gall, et cetera. So I think that got her on his radar screen. And there's also been this issue of whether or not Trump and his running mate Mike Pence are going to endorse people like John McCain and Paul Ryan and Kelly Ayotte as well. So, you know, who are obviously Kelly Ayotte in particular in a tough reelection bid here. So she kind of got brought into this, and Donald Trump said, you know, she's given him zero support. She's in a very difficult position because, you know, at some level, she needs Trump supporters to vote for her. She needs good Republican turnout in particular. On the other hand, she wants to make a case that she's her own person and that she's going to speak her mind whenever she feels like somebody has stepped out of line. So, you know, she really got pulled into this big time. And I think last night the Mike Pence's spokesperson issued like a one sentence endorsement of her and I think John McCain as well. He came out and endorsed Paul Ryan also. So it's just, you know, we're sort of where we've been all along, where, you know, Ayotte trying to avoid Trump but also be critical of him but not wanting to over-alienate Republican voters. And I think Trump is coming to do a rally this weekend on Saturday evening, so maybe she'll have a chance to kind of mend fences, although I'm not waiting to see that.
So, Trent, Kelly Ayotte now has the support of the Republican vice presidential nominee, Mike Pence. And but Trump still pointedly withholding that endorsement from Ayotte, from John McCain, from Paul Ryan. And interestingly, at one point not so long ago, Donald Trump spoke very effusively about Kelly Ayotte, saying she'd make a fine vice president and saying lots of nice things about her, even though she still had not formally endorsed him and really put her weight behind his campaign.
Sure. And when you talk to political watchers, they're kind of split on whether or not this is a good thing for Kelly Ayotte. Half of the people say it's a great thing for Kelly Ayotte because she can distance herself from Trump, who isn't doing as well in the polls lately, and hope to sort of project this moderate centrist image and hopefully bring over some of those people who are not going to be voting for Trump but will be focusing on down ballot races. And then the other half of people say this is terrible. This is not – this is a very difficult race. The New Hampshire Senate race is an incredibly difficult race. Ayotte needs all the help she can get. And having the top of the ticket essentially turn you into a national news story for not such great reasons is very bad news, especially in August.
And we heard in those comments, Casey, from Donald Trump to the Washington Post that he said, I'm outpolling her in her own home state of New Hampshire. I guess he hadn't seen the latest WBUR poll, which just came out this week, which shows a big change overall from the numbers we saw in May when Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump were roughly even. But lots to look at in those numbers, for sure.
In fairness to Donald Trump, the WBUR poll had not yet been released at the time he made those comments. But, you know, it is important to note that, A, they are not running in the same race. So that's not exactly an apples-to-apples comparison to be making. But also at the time that he made those comments, Senator Ayotte was, in fact, doing better in the polling averages than Donald Trump was. At that time earlier this week, you know, it was a very close race between Senator Ayotte and Governor Hassan for that Senate seat. She was up by about 0.6 of a percent. Donald Trump, meanwhile, was trailing Hillary Clinton in the polling averages at the time. She was Clinton was up by about 3.7 percentage points. At this point, Hassan has edged out Ayotte as a result of, you know, the WBUR poll that you mentioned. Now, again, we're several months away from the election, so this is all going to, you know, shake out in different ways between now and then. But so Hassan is just slightly ahead of Ayotte, still a very close race. But the margin between Clinton and Trump has continued to widen. So I don't know that I think if we were doing a PolitiFact segment on that, we would probably rate that mostly false at this point.
I'm going to go out on a limb and say Trump probably had no idea what the data said about him relative to Kelly Ayotte. He just, you know, he probably thought he won New Hampshire. You know, here's this Republican senator in New Hampshire who seems to be struggling. And so he's doing better than her. I mean, that's in his mind. He's doing better than her, sort of irrespective of what the polling data says. And, you know, he in this WBUR poll, he's at like 32%, I think. Clinton's at 47%. Kelly Ayotte's at 40. So she's clearly, you know, 8 points up on him if you look at it. It's not exactly head-to-head, as you were saying, but nonetheless, clearly not a true statement. I don't know that that really matters to him politically.
I do think it's interesting just in terms of, you know, keeping in mind that Senator Ayotte is, in fact, in a primary right now. So it's not as though she's necessarily locked up the nomination. There is Jim Rubens, who is challenging her, and he has kind of, you know, cornered the market on if she's not going to align herself with Trump, I am. I'm looking at his Twitter feed right now, and his most recent one is K Street Kelly Ayotte has divorced conservatives and now Donald Trump. I'm the fighter that he needs. And, you know, he's touting endorsements from the Conservative Majority Project, a number of other groups. So really trying to, like, edge in on the, you know, more conservative wing of the party, whereas I think we see Senator Ayotte continuing to try to forge kind of a middle-of-the-road path here.
Trent. And I think the Jim Rubens thing is interesting because you can see just how quickly the political winds can shift. A year ago, he sent an email to supporters saying, I would never vote for Donald Trump. I would never support Donald Trump. And now he's Trump's biggest supporter in the Republican Senate race. So it's very interesting to watch. And the same thing is happening with Kelly Ayotte. You have to look back at what happened to her this week. She started the week having to denounce her the top of the ticket. She made national news, not by her choosing, because the Republican presidential candidate wouldn't endorse her. And so this is an entire week now, and in a very important week leading up to the race, to the election, where she wasn't talking about Maggie Hassan. She wasn't talking about issues. She was defending herself from people in her own party. And so it's going to be a very difficult thing to get everyone thinking again about the race between Hassan and Ayotte when Ayotte's got all of this other baggage.
Dean, we are coming off of the two national political conventions. How much of what we're seeing in these numbers from the Massing poll and WBUR compared to what we saw, say, in 2012 or 2008? I mean, is this typical convention kind of bounce, or is there something perhaps different at work here?
I think, you know, it's interesting. I think, you know, you typically count on the convention to give the candidate at least sort of a modest bounce. A lot of times that kind of fades out over the course of the subsequent weeks, and then by the time you get to Labor Day, you have a better read at what the race actually looks like. You know, in this case, there's sort of been a consensus that the Democrats ran a very good convention. I think Hillary Clinton's numbers certainly reflect that. There's increasing data to show that the Republican convention actually hurt Donald Trump, even if it excited kind of his core supporters. I think that's problematic. He's had as I think Paul Ryan said just yesterday, it's been a very strange couple of weeks for Donald Trump. Certainly not helped him either. You know, when you start to see these polling numbers move in terms of your qualification to be president, I think that's problematic as well. That said, you know, my experience with this over many years is that there is kind of an ebb and flow to the narrative here. I'm sure there'll be a comeback story for Donald Trump at some point, and Hillary Clinton will fall back at some point. So we may go through several more cycles of this who's up, who's down over the next couple of months. But you know, I think that the Democrats are probably pretty happy with where they are right now, even if her current lead in a number of these national and state polls is maybe a little larger than what it will be when we get into the fall. But I think Trump has had a really rough, you know, the convention was problematic. I think they're starting to realize that. But Trump has had a rough run for the last couple of weeks.
One of the conclusions that the people behind this WBUR poll found, Trent, was that Democrats have largely coalesced behind Hillary Clinton, not so much among Republicans. And we saw an example of that in New Hampshire, where there was a report from NBC News that former U.S. Senator Gordon Humphrey from New Hampshire, who has been a John Kasich supporter and a very open Donald Trump critic throughout, not exactly a moderate Republican, not exactly an establishment icon, but he said, if it's a close race in New Hampshire, I'm going to back Hillary Clinton.
Yes.
And that's an interesting dynamic you don't see in most presidential years.
Right. And he had some choice words to describe Donald Trump, too, in that interview. You know, we have been doing reporting on this all week, that there are Republicans who basically say that the comments about the Gold Star family, that was the breaking point, that we've seen all of these different small little scandals happen, you know, factual errors, you know, slips of the tongue, jokes that maybe were inappropriate. But this was the last straw. And they are now calling on – we had an interview with Senator Jack Barnes, who is saying that he is withholding his support. I mean, he's a very well-known conservative who was in the state Senate.
And fairly outspoken himself.
Yes. Yep. And he says, I will not endorse other Republicans in the state unless they denounce Donald Trump. So the Republican Party has an issue here. I think that's an easy thing that we can say. The question will be just where does the split happen? Where does everyone break down in supporting the traditional candidates, and how many people will break away?
And is this a tipping point where we're starting to see more and more Republicans either withdraw or openly withdraw their support from Trump or openly support Hillary Clinton or some other candidate? You know, that the issue with Kelly Ayotte has been, and I think Democrats are questioning her and saying, you know, if you find this individual appalling and full of gall, why are you still supporting him? And I think that's a fair question.
Today on The Exchange, it's the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup. We're taking a look at some of the top New Hampshire news stories of the week, and we hope you'll join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Facebook or Twitter. One New Hampshire Republican who has, up to this point, stayed in support of Donald Trump is Republican candidate for Governor Chris Sununu. And I bring him up, Trent, because he sat down with the union leader this week and had a conversation on a number of issues, including his thoughts on the presidential race. I wanted to bring up a couple more noteworthy items from that conversation, starting with education, which is an issue that Chris Sununu brought up. It's one that's been big with Republicans in recent days, speaking of the school system in Croydon and a legal issue they've had with the state. Let's hear some of what Chris Sununu had to say.
And Croydon, you know, absolutely has to be championed as an example of where we can't let this happen again. We can't let a governor and an administration come down on individuals because they're making the best choices for their kids. That's unconscionable to me.
That's Chris Sununu, executive counselor and Republican hopeful for governor, speaking with the New Hampshire union leader this week. What's the background on this issue with Croydon, for those who don't know, and why is it resonating in conservative circles right now?
Sure. And just a shameless plug, I want to let listeners know that we are, this entire month, we will be profiling all of the candidates who are in primaries. So you can listen in at unionleader.com. They're live. You can ask questions.
It was a fascinating conversation.
It was a great conversation, and people asked some great questions. But on Croydon, here's what's happening. The Croydon School District has five middle schoolers that they don't have a school for. And so they were using public tax dollars to send them to a Montessori school in a neighboring town. We're talking about five middle schoolers here. The governor's office and the attorney general sued the town to stop them from doing this. And so far, the state has won and has a judge has ruled that they cannot use public tax dollars to send these five students to a Montessori school in another town. Sununu says that people should have choice about where you get to send your students. You get to send your children. He said, I think the phrase was something like the governor came down like a hammer on this small town, and that if he were elected, that he would allow parents to make their own decisions about where students went to school.
He also recently outlined his economic plan, and when he met with the union leader, he talked about how businesses tend to think in terms of 10 or 20 years at a time, while politicians look at 2 years or 4 years. I heard similar rhetoric from a Democratic candidate for governor, Steve Marchand, not so long ago. Is the state really that short-sighted as these candidates suggest? And if so, on what fronts when it comes to the economy?
Sure. And I think people at the Department of Resources and Economic Development would disagree. They feel like they're doing a lot of work to make sure that businesses are coming to New Hampshire. Sununu's plan was the Division of Resources and Economic Development, DRED, has a number of different groups within it, including economic development, state parks, forestry. And his idea was to break out economic development, that division, and make the director of economic development report directly to the governor. How much would that do? I'm not sure. He also said that he was going to spend a lot of time out of state recruiting businesses to New Hampshire. But he said the biggest challenge, and you're right, we hear this on both sides of the aisle. The biggest challenge is that businesses don't want to come here because they're concerned about the opioid epidemic. They're concerned about younger workers not being able to find younger workers in New Hampshire and not being able to keep people here.
And one thing that both Sununu and another Republican hopeful for Governor Ted Gatzes, the mayor of Manchester, brought up was the Division of Resources and Economic Development's actual name. I think Ted Gatzes said something to the effect of, surely we can come up with a better acronym for our economic development team than DRED.
Right. Yes. The Department of Resources and Economic Development, DRED. It is people have talked about changing the name for years and it just hasn't taken off.
Well, after a short break, we're going to continue our conversation about this conversation Chris Sununu had with the union leader. And we'll take your comments and questions as well about all of the New Hampshire news of the week. You can join us at the exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. After a short break, we continue the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup here on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. We're taking a look at the top New Hampshire news stories of the week, and you can join us at 1-800-892-6477, 8928892NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org, and you can also find us on Facebook and Twitter. With us for the hour is Dean Spiliotis of Southern New Hampshire University, Trent Spinner of the New Hampshire Union Leader and Sunday News, and NHPR's digital reporter, Casey McDermott. Trent, just before the break, we were talking about the conversation the Union Leader had this week with candidate for governor, Republican Chris Sununu. And I had a couple more questions on that front. Chris Sununu, of course, famously cast that vote that authorized the state funding for Planned Parenthood. What did he have to say about that?
Well, here's how he explained it. So the state does business with Planned Parenthood, and our publisher asked him if he felt like it was appropriate, given some of those recent videos. There were criminal investigations relating to the videos. All of the criminal investigations, the videos were essentially debunked. But, you know, the publisher was asking, is it okay to do business with a company that talks so casually about it over wine and cheese, for example, which was in some of those videos? And what Sununu said was he voted against the contract with Planned Parenthood while they were under investigation because he said, look, if it's a snowplow contractor or, a health provider, I don't think the state should be doing business with anyone while they are under investigation. He said, I would like to see how the investigation pans out before I vote on the contract. So as everyone knows, he voted against the contract. And then when it came up before the council again, he voted retroactively to fund the contract. So, he said, look, this hurts me politically, but I feel like I need to do what's right for my constituents. And then he went on to say, we asked a couple of follow-up questions. He went on to say that he would be open to an investigation into Planned Parenthood of New England, into their practices here. There was never a formal investigation up here. He said he would be open to that, and Democrats really pounced on that. They say, look, all these other investigations, including in more conservative states, didn't find anything. There should be no investigation in New Hampshire.
Finally, this was a line that really struck me listening to that conversation. Chris Sununu said, and I'll just quote, Northern Pass is going to happen, and I believe it should.
That's right. Northern Pass is going to happen. And this is something that we've been hearing from politicians and from Eversource in the last few weeks. Eversource had an investor call, and a high-ranking official said, this is going to happen, and we have the support of the governor, which was interesting to us. And now you have an executive counselor saying Northern Pass is going to happen. And that's sort of been the chatter, is that they finally have the political momentum to make this happen. Obviously, it's going through a regulatory process, and there are still steps left there. But Northern Pass, the people who are pushing Northern Pass really feel like they've got this locked up.
Oftentimes, Dean, you do not hear politicians so bluntly saying this is going to happen, knowing that the opposition to Northern Pass has not gone away.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, I think, as Trent said, Democrats and Sununu opponents are going to jump on that. You know, maybe they have some insight now into how the process is going to move forward. You know, sometimes that is the case. They sort of have a genuine sense that it's locked up. Other times it's a little bit of wishful thinking. You know, this has been going on for so many years now. There's always going to be an opportunity for further litigation, but we'll see. You know, perhaps they feel like, on the big issues, they have it good to go.
And if you have to look at the Northern Pass story, you have to look at the entire arc of the story, right? When it first came out, there was very strong opposition. And what's happened over the last 5 or 6 years is that the people working on the project have really gone out of their way to meet individually with homeowners, business owners, groups in the North Country to sell them on this plan. And so you've had all these groups that were totally opposed, and now some of them are they're not for it, but they're not against it. And some people who are for it. And what they've done is just basically pick them off one at a time. And they feel like they've reached that critical mass now where they do have enough support to get the project through.
Another piece of political news this week. Casey, you were covering an event with the groups Americans for Prosperity, which got a number of New Hampshire candidates to sign their pledge. What's in that pledge, first of all, and then who was involved in signing it?
Right. So Americans for Prosperity, this was the New Hampshire arm of a much larger network that has kind of chapters in states across the country. It's, you know, often people will refer to it as the kind of Koch brothers group. They're the kind of famous mega donors who helped to launch this group to advance basically kind of anti-tax, anti-regulation. They frame it as kind of economic prosperity principles. So the pledge that they ask candidates to sign is kind of an outgrowth of the longstanding New Hampshire anti-tax, anti-sales tax, anti-income tax pledge. But it also includes planks that, you know, this year asks them to pledge to pass right-to-work legislation, which is basically kind of, you know, weakening unions' ability to make membership or dues mandatory for their members, and also to oppose all forms of the Affordable Care Act in New Hampshire, which includes Medicaid expansion. And that was what was kind of a sticking point and kind of interesting this year, because as we've seen, the Medicaid expansion that is currently in place in New Hampshire does enjoy bipartisan support from a handful of Republicans who helped to craft that deal and make sure that it was extended. So what you saw this year, and what's interesting is in the governor's race, while in years past, all of the Republican candidates for governor have been pretty quick to sign on with AFP, align themselves with the pledge, use it as kind of, you know, here's what I stand for. This is kind of another, you know, conservative credential to add to their, you know, resume as they're running. But this year we have two candidates, Manchester Mayor Ted Gatsis and Executive Councilor Chris Sununu, who are holding back on signing that pledge. And both of them have cited concerns about what that would mean for the future of the people who are currently covered by the state's Medicaid expansion. Both of them said at a debate last month in Windham that they weren't ready to commit to signing it. They were not at the pledge signing earlier this week, and they representatives for their campaigns have said that, you know, they're interested in coming up with a, you know, kind of New Hampshire solution to this problem. But until that happens, they can't commit to putting their name down that, you know, they can commit to this pledge at this point. So I think it's interesting, and it's indicative of a larger rift that you see between the establishment Republicans in the state and this kind of outside group that really is establishing itself as kind of a political force in its own right in New Hampshire politics. We did some reporting on this earlier this month that you can see on our website. But AFP is kind of, you know, in many ways building up the kind of grassroots apparatus, the kind of political advocacy apparatus that you would expect out of maybe the Republican Party or traditional conservative groups. And at times, their principles can clash with, as we said, the Republicans in the state. So that was on display at this pledge signing in the absence of some of the gubernatorial candidates. But Trent's paper, the union leader, also had kind of an interesting story this week about the fact that the pledge signing was actually moved out of an event space in the legislative office building because House Speaker Sean Jasper, who is a Republican, was unhappy with the group kind of actively canvassing against incumbent Republican House members. And he felt that, you know, they shouldn't, you know, be using that space if it's going to be politicized. So I think that it'll be interesting just to see how, as this group continues to grow, you know, how well it gets along or doesn't get along with the other Republicans in the state.
You mentioned the two candidates for the Republican nomination for governor that did not sign that pledge, Ted Gatsis and Chris Sununu. And let's hear now from the two that did. This is State Representative Frank Edelblue and State Senator Jeanie Forrester talking about the decision to sign the Americans for Prosperity pledge.
I think it's important for any candidate to put on record the things that they believe in so that people who are voting for them will know what's important to them. And so taking this pledge just reflects the things that are important to me.
I believe it's very helpful, and every time I go out and talk to folks about it, I tell them I have taken the pledge in the past, and I will this time, and I have.
So those are two candidates for New Hampshire governor, Republicans Frank Edelblue and Jeanie Forrester, talking about signing the AFP, Americans for Prosperity, pledge this week. A little bit more political news. Dean, First District Representative Frank Ginta put out a campaign video this week outlining some of his priorities if he were to be reelected. He talked about the opioid crisis, talked about health care, and he talked about trade. Let's hear what he had to say.
While I believe in free trade, it must also be fair trade. So I oppose the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which will kill good jobs.
Okay, that's Congressman Frank Ginta speaking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership. But what's notable here, of course, is that Frank Ginta was a solidly pro-free trade guy and has been in Congress and, in fact, voted to, I think the union leader reported this, Trent, voted to authorize fast-track negotiating authority for the White House over the Trans-Pacific Partnership. So what's going on here that he would now say, I'm for free trade and for fair trade, I'm against the TPP?
Well, to the extent that the Republican Party is now Donald Trump's party, it's much more protectionist. Trump has hit these trade deals very hard as costing American jobs and being unfair, and he's going to renegotiate them and cut better deals. The interesting thing about Frank Ginta is, in addition to supporting the fast-track authorization for the president, he signed a letter. This is, you talked about this. He signed a letter declaring his support. Over the years, Congressman Ginta has kind of been good at sort of reading the political landscape and kind of figuring out, where his position should be. He has supported free trade in the past. I recall when he was elected in 2010, he was kind of ran as sort of a Tea Party Republican. And then in his reelection bid, he's been talking more about bipartisanship. So this is a little bit of a change in position for him. But it is keeping with Trump and the Republican Party under Trump, and he has been a supporter of Trump. So I think that's in part what is driving this.
On the Democratic side, the State Employees Association this week endorsed Democrat Colin Van Ostern for governor, not long after a powerful firefighters union backed Mark Connelly, another Democrat. Democrats have long courted union support, Dean. That's not new. But in New Hampshire labor, can you explain some of the dynamics? How important are these two particular unions these kinds of candidates?
They're both very big unions, very important unions. Union support has traditionally been a very important component of Democratic politics in the state. They provide a lot of resources. They help with getting out the vote. They help with phone banking. Many of our Democratic governors have had very strong support from, state employees unions, first responder unions. So these are big endorsements. And it was interesting, the Mark Connelly firefighters endorsement broke first. And that was viewed as kind of a big coup and a huge endorsement. And then the Van Ostern people campaign came right back with the state employees union. So it's always critical to Democratic politics here in the state and nationally. The right to work legislation that a lot of states have pushed, it's been something that unions have opposed. Unions overall nationally and, over the decades, you've seen a shift from kind of the biggest unions used to be the kind of manufacturing unions, auto workers, et cetera, steel. It's now shifted to being education, public employees,
service.
First responders, service, exactly. So the change in the type of union strength and also, sort of an overall portion, I believe it's reduced as well. So maybe not as big as it once was, but still big, certainly within the context of Democratic politics in the state.
Final political note, Trent. Police in Manchester have arrested a man called Leland Eisenberg for allegedly robbing a bank. If you've heard that name before, it's because Leland Eisenberg has a somewhat infamous place in New Hampshire's presidential primary history.
That's right. Leland Eisenberg in 2007 took some hostages at Hillary Clinton's campaign office in Rochester. If you don't remember it, you may have been living under a rock at the time. It was the biggest national story. Hillary Clinton flew up here. And I think it's really important to highlight here that Mr. Eisenberg is struggling with mental health issues. He said it. State officials have said it. And he has spent time in prison, in halfway houses, trying to find treatment. He just hasn't been successful. He's not a violent offender. He is someone who is deeply struggling with mental health issues, tried to rob a bank. And the way he did it, I wouldn't even use the word rob. I mean, he is struggling to find help. And the system, there's no ability for him to find it, because when he's in prison, he's getting treatment, but he has a maximum sentence and he gets paroled and leaves. And then he's basically put on the street and there's nothing for him to do. There's no support system for him. He obviously a struggling man. You've heard about him, and I wouldn't be surprised if you hear about him again.
This is the New Hampshire Weekly News Roundup on The Exchange. I'm Brady Carlson. We're taking a look at the top New Hampshire news stories of the week. Join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also find us on Twitter and Facebook. KC, New Hampshire saw some rain this week, but apparently not enough to head off what now looks like the worst drought in about a decade. And now the state has something to say to residents in basically all of central and southern New Hampshire.
Which is basically don't use a lot of water.
Right.
So as Emily Corwin reported earlier this week, we have more than 100 water systems in the state, which includes kind of, you know, when we say water systems, we mean like local municipal water systems. But sometimes a municipality can have multiple different systems within the same one. But they all have there's about 100, more than 100 that have formal bans on outdoor watering. And other restrictions that are in place. And you can see a list of that we have on our website via a link from the state. But beyond that, as you said, the state is basically just urging people to conserve water and to limit outdoor watering to every other day between the hours of 7 p.m. and 8 p.m. And if you're in any of seven counties in a severe drought, and that includes Sullivan, Merrimack, Belknap, Stratford, Rockingham, Hillsborough, and Cheshire counties, the state is recommending stopping all outdoor watering except if you're going to water your plants by hand. So no hose for now.
Meanwhile, we heard from Bruce Silley this week on The Exchange. He's a New Hampshire official with the U.S. Department of Agriculture, who says that agency has begun the process of applying for a disaster declaration with the Secretary of Agriculture on behalf of farmers. Also at play here that a number of towns and cities have put in mandatory water restrictions, some of which residents are following, some of which maybe not so much. Trent, at a time when the weather has been bringing all sorts of heat to the state, there's a different issue related to heat coming up for the state government. The company that has provided steam heat to the state capitol and a number of other state government buildings is shutting down. Concord Steam being acquired by Liberty Utilities, pending approval by the Public Utilities Commission. And that means that the state is going to be switching to natural gas. And the union leader reported that may wind up being a costly process.
It's going to be very expensive. If you didn't know, there are steam lines running underneath underground in Concord, and they supply heat to 25 state office buildings. Over the next year and a half, all of these office buildings are going to have to switch from steam heat to natural gas. And it's going to cost the state somewhere around $15 million. This is something that the state was planning for. They understood that Concord Steam was having some issues. They were planning to switch over, but over a period of years. The other thing with Concord Steam is that they burn wood here, and there are and they support the local economy. So there are a lot of changes that will be happening, expensive changes that will impact a lot of people. And it's going to be happening pretty fast. I mean, imagine having to switch over 25 different furnaces. That's an expensive proposition.
And there will be more to come on that, no doubt. Finally, before we take a break here, Casey, there's a daycare center in Portsmouth which had a lot of visitors, maybe not wanted visitors, and it's all because of that little video game that's got everybody staring at their phones these days.
I've got to say, I was out in Manchester a few weeks ago and saw this kind of roving band of teens that I can only assume were playing this game, Pokemon Go. But as you mentioned, there's a daycare center that is maybe less enthusiastic about this game. And for those who are not kind of children of the 90s, it's this virtual reality upgrade on this card game where you I was not a Pokemon player, so forgive me if I'm getting this wrong, but you collect animals. But basically, a daycare was a hot spot for this. As you can imagine, it's not great to have a lot of strangers lurking around, so they had to be asked to be removed from the game. That's kind of long and short of it.
And they succeeded in doing that. Yep. After a short break, we'll continue our look at the New Hampshire News of the Week. Join us with your comments and questions at 1-800-892-6477. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. This is the weekly New Hampshire News Roundup on NHPR. I'm Brady Carlson. We're taking a look at the top New Hampshire news stories of the week, and we hope you'll join us at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Our email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also share your comments and questions on Facebook and Twitter. This week, two NHPR reporters produced a series of stories on what it's like to be homeless in New Hampshire. Joining us now are those reporters, NHPR's Natasha Haverty and Jack Rodolico. Welcome.
Thanks, Brady.
Thanks for having us.
Homelessness is unfortunately not new. What made you decide to take a look at this issue now?
Well, this past winter, Tasha and I have been talking about working together for a little while, and we talked about homelessness as a project. And right as we started doing some research, we heard about this guy who was homeless in Concord, who had no legs, who was in a wheelchair, who dragged himself into his campsite every night. And it was just this really striking image to us, and we thought, well, that's somebody we want to talk to. 2 weeks later, he was dead. He got hit by a car and was killed in Concord. And it sort of like underscored for us just how fragile life is for people who are on the street. And so it just sort of encouraged us to really dive into this and try to figure out who he was and how homelessness works in the state.
And then another thing that happened pretty quickly into our reporting was we learned that 10 years ago, New Hampshire had made this sort of 10-year promise, like a lot of states had in 2006, made this 10-year plan to end homelessness by this year. So that was another good excuse to look at it now.
And it hadn't happened, obviously.
You mentioned that person at the center of your reporting, Gene Parker. You weren't able to talk to him, but you were able to hear his voice in the stories because of some voicemails that he sent out. Let's hear a little bit of his voice before we learn more about his story.
Hi, Lisa. This is Gino. I'm at the shelter. Sunday's my birthday, but I still want to be out of the cold. So give me a call, will you? Bye.
That's the voice of Gene Parker speaking to a friend on a voicemail. What does Gene Parker's life, Tasha, tell us about homelessness in New Hampshire?
Well, in a way, Gene Parker lived a kind of homelessness that maybe comes to mind when we think about homelessness. He was a guy who lived on the street, out in the open a lot of the time, you know, holding a sign at an intersection. So he tells us about a kind of homelessness, which we call, or advocates in the government calls, chronic homelessness. Folks who have at least one obstacle that keeps them on the street, whether it's like a disability, addiction, a criminal offense. Gene Parker happened, as we did more reporting, we learned he had all of those things, all of those obstacles. So one thing looking at his life tells us is that the more obstacles stacked against you, the harder it is for you to get out of that situation and, frankly, for advocates to find a place to put you.
And how much it costs, you know, and that's one of the reasons the federal government and advocates target the chronically homeless population in trying to house them, because there's something like 10, depending on where you go in the country, they're 10 to 15 to 25% of the homeless population. They're the minority, but at least half of the money spent on homelessness goes to these individuals. That's because you live on the street, you wind up in the emergency room maybe multiple times a week. You wind up running in with the police. I mean, mm-hmm. Gene Parker had 89 interactions with Concord police over 5 years. 80. I mean, it's huge. I mean, that's once every couple weeks over the course of 5 years. So the public tab for individuals who are chronically homeless is enormous. It's something like $30,000 to $50,000 per year per homeless person, whereas the cost of just finding an apartment for that individual is maybe a quarter of that.
And that's been the argument made by people who have argued for that housing first model, that if you put people in housing and then deal with the other problems,
right,
then you can start to deal with those issues and also get people off the streets at the same time. Now, Gene Parker's story is that sort of, as you put it, that very traditional model of what we think of when we think of homelessness. But it's also very urban in a mm-hmm. way. It's a city kind of homelessness. And New Hampshire is a largely rural state. So what are we seeing in, you know, outside of Concord or Manchester or Nashua?
Well, so here's one of the surprising things maybe to some of us that we learned digging into this is for a lot of folks in New Hampshire who don't have a home, they have a roof over their head. It's not theirs. You know, it might be that they're doubled up with friends or family, often in some kind of unstable or even unsafe situation. In other cases, it's shelters, but then a lot of those shelters close in the winter. And in other cases, it's literally renting a room by the week at a motel or a hotel. So that's why we sort of stumbled upon this place that was a motel in a really rural part of the state, Effingham, New Hampshire, and decided to focus on who's living at this one motel up there.
And here's one of the people that you met there. Her name is Ami. Let's hear what she had to say.
This January coming up, I'll be 50. Wow. It happens fast. And I hope not to be homeless or staying at the PK at 50. I'm going to keep my fingers crossed. Not that it's an awful place to be, but it's not where I want to be.
So that's a woman named Ami talking about life at the PK Motel. Jack, not living on the street, but not having a place of her own and clearly wanting one. So how does a person end up in a place like this?
So it's basically all of the reasons people get stuck in poverty are the reasons why people wind up at the PK Motel or any number of other motels and rooming houses around the state. You know, we talk to people who – so for Ami, she had an instance of domestic violence years ago that permanently disabled her. So she is on Social Security. We met a lot of people there on Social Security because of various injuries. Young people on Social Security, people in their 20s. We met people who were just born into poverty. And one woman who lived in a motel with her mother until last year. Her mother passed away when this young woman was 18 or 19. She now has two children and is living with her fiance in this motel. So that means her kids are the third generation in her family to be living in a motel in New Hampshire. And so, you know, it's being born into poverty. It's addiction. You know, that was another really common thing that we heard up there at the PK Motel. And so all of these reasons, I mean, it's really, you know, the story, if you go out on the campaign trail, which we have as reporters, you hear people talk about the economy, how they feel like the economy is stuck. When you talk to people who are homeless, they are experiencing the same exact thing that the middle income folks are, only for them it's much more dire. One lost paycheck is the difference between becoming homeless, one illness, you know, one hospital stay. So it's people who are low income, poor, but right on the margin of just losing their house and dipping in and out of homelessness, sometimes for years.
These are just a few of the voices that you heard as you reported this series. Were there others that really stood out and made you think differently about homelessness in this state?
One thing that really struck us were this, you know, in order to work on stories like this, you really rely on finding those gatekeepers, the people who have committed their lives to not letting homelessness kind of stay invisible, because it is something we don't want to think about, you know, whether it's someone like Gene Parker or, you know, a motel at the end of a rural road. So we were really struck by some of the advocates that we met. One woman who agreed to drive us around, basically, Effingham and Ossipee.
And point out houses and say there are homeless people in that house.
And in a way that, you know, we would have never been able to see or kind of uncover if we were just driving around there on our own. And then by that same token, folks, you know, right here in Concord who work for an organization, some of them or some are just kind of on their own, literally walking into camps where a lot of homeless folks live, sometimes in not safe conditions, delivering meals that they made in their own kitchen, just thinking, if I have a meal, you know, why shouldn't these guys?
Before we let you go, Jack, I wanted to ask you a couple of quick questions about this week's news regarding Brady Sullivan. The EPA is issuing fines to that real estate developer over the ongoing issues at the Mill West apartment complex in Manchester. So what's the EPA saying here?
The EPA is saying that Brady Sullivan broke two different federal laws that govern how we deal with lead paint. Lead is a toxic. It's a neurotoxin, particularly for children. It can stunt intellectual development. It can stunt, you know, it can literally lower your IQ, whether you're an adult or a child. So it's particularly dangerous for children, developing fetuses. So a year ago, we've known for a while that Brady Sullivan hired this subcontractor that didn't have the permits, didn't have the training, and did just really shoddy sandblasting work and spread lead dust all over this building. So we knew that they broke that law about how to repair lead paint. What the EPA says is when they went in to inspect, they actually went further back and they looked at the lead disclosure forms that tenants had to sign when they moved in. Now, when you move into an apartment, a landlord has to tell you what they know about lead hazards in the building. They basically said many of those lead disclosure forms were inaccurate. So people were not getting – so prior to this construction job, these apartments were not necessarily safe. They're seeking about $300,000 in fines. The bulk of that is for the small subcontractor. About $130,000 is from Brady Sullivan. They're not necessarily going to pay that full amount. They've got a month to respond to EPA. But this is sort of the latest. The problems that have stemmed from this one Brady Sullivan building in Manchester – continue to balloon. We know that there is an potentially, you know, they won't talk about it, federal government, the EPA won't talk about it, but we know that they at least got a tip that there was dumping of lead and asbestos from Mill West in Manchester at another Brady Sullivan building in Lawrence, Massachusetts. That was the accusation. We know for a fact that there was dumping of other contaminants from contaminated soil from Mill West to a gravel pit in Londonderry. We also know that there are air quality problems in this building. So it's really a mess. I mean, and Brady Sullivan is sort of taking it one step at a time. What I was really struck by this week was, you know, I've been asking them for comments for a year about this issue. This was the first time they said, we're sorry. And that was really striking to me. This was the first time that they took a sort of contrite tone rather than just say, you know, we're doing the best we can. There's not necessarily a problem. Many of their statements in the past have been proven to not be true. They took a different approach this time and just said, we're sorry. But whether or not that's good enough, we'll see. They're still being sued by these tenants. EPA is still seeking damages, which they haven't agreed to pay. It's far from over.
And what are those tenants and their lawyers saying now? Are they pleased with what the EPA did?
No. Not really. I mean, yes and no, I should say. I talked to some yesterday who said they were pleased that the EPA did something. I talked to others who said it's too little too late for them. They're saying, why did it take a year to come to this conclusion? And also, they're frustrated that Brady Sullivan in this past year, while these problems have been ongoing, have been allowed to move more people into the building. And so I talked to one tenant who's really frustrated by that the EPA didn't do more to just at least stall new tenants from moving in. The EPA may not have that authority, frankly, but they're not. People aren't necessarily happy with the way this whole thing has shaken down, which is why they're still suing.
Let's take a call now from Ken, who's in Antrim. Hi, Ken. You're on the Exchange.
Hi. I know it's a little bit off topic, but I work in the foster care system, and like your last caller, she's in a three-bag hotel motel by the week. I must bring these children court ordered to these places for supervised visits, and I see drug dealers, I see people with guns, and I'm bringing these children into a dangerous situation. They're playing in the parking lot, but there's no place else to play. I'm responsible for them and their well-being, and it's court ordered. I just think it's totally insane. That's about all I have to say.
Ken, thanks so much for weighing in. It comes back to something you were saying a moment ago, Natasha. A roof over your head isn't necessarily just a home.
Yeah, Ken, frankly, what you're describing, you know, really rings true to our experience just spending a little bit of time at that motel we described. I think Jack and I and some of the tenants we were standing with literally saw, you know, a drug deal go down. And people talked about that this is the best that they are figuring out for their kids right now, but it's a constant sort of state of anxiety and grappling with how do I get out of here next week or next month, you know, never kind of relaxing from that feeling that they're putting their kids in a pretty unsafe situation. So we hear that.
And it's often public money that puts people in these motels because, you know, if you go to your local welfare office, you know, you can get some housing support for a little while. Often they get sent to motels just like this. And so sometimes it's the public money that's sending people there in the first place.
That's NHPR's Jack Rodolico and Natasha Haverty. You'll find their series on homelessness in New Hampshire, as well as this week's news on Brady Sullivan at NHPR.org. Thanks for joining us, you two.
Thank you, Brady.
A few more items from this week's news with our panel for the hour, Dean Spiliotis, Trent Spinner, and Casey McDermott. Trent, we learned this week that a store in Raymond sold a winning Powerball ticket worth $487 million with just one important catch.
Oh, no one has showed up to claim the ticket yet. There have been so many rumors about who the winner is. It is, and we've been tracking them down all week. No one has picked up the ticket. And just for the record, I want to say for the people who keep calling, we have not published the name of the winner because we don't know who it is either.
We don't know who the winner is. I did like the state's advice that if the person who won isn't from this state, would you consider moving?
right, nice. Because they wouldn't have to pay income tax.
Right.
Income tax.
Finally, this week, a big anniversary around these parts. NHPR had a birthday. It was in August 1981 that Granite State Public Radio first went on the air. There was a party, there was a poem, there was a countdown, and then after A short delay, then we started to hear the dulcet tones of Sanford Unger, accompanied by synthesizer music. So let's hear a little bit of the countdown, a short break, and then some of the first sign-on for then Granite State Public Radio, now NHPR. And here comes the first sounds of NHPR in 1981.
Tonight we welcome WEVO in Concord, New Hampshire, to the NPR and All Things Considered family.
The program is edited by Jim Angle and Gary Covino.
So that's what New Hampshire Public Radio sounded like in 1981. Casey, I think we should bring that synth music back.
I think it's pretty groovy. I will say, too, that if anyone's interested, we do have an album of kind of throwback photos on our Facebook page, and you will probably recognize at least a few familiar faces from New Hampshire politics and presidential campaigns over the years.
Well, as we wrap up this hour, I'd ask what we always ask. What stories will you be following next week, Casey McDermott?
So I'm going to be checking in on the Republican governor's race just to kind of see where about a month out from the primary, what they're doing on the trail and how they're positioning themselves heading into that election.
Trent Spinner?
We want to find the Powerball winner, and if this person doesn't want to go through all the hassle, the publicity, the press conferences, I'll happily take the ticket.
There we go, Dean Spiliotis.
Yeah, they have a year. Consult a lawyer, set up a trust, get all your ducks in a row before you cash that ticket. It's all about the presidential race, the statewide race primaries. People are going on vacation, but August is a busy political month nonetheless.
We'll be keeping an eye on all of those stories. And remember, our conversation continues online on Facebook and at nhpr.org. Casey McDermott, Trent Spinner, Dean Spiliotis, great to have you with us for the hour.
Thank you.
Thanks, Brady.
The Exchange is a production of New Hampshire Public Radio. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our senior producer is Ellen Grimm. Our producer is Jessica Hunt. Our intern is Sam Ruthier. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our theme music was composed by Bob Lord. And I'm Brady Carlson.